prayer. Guys, I really appreciate Pastor Bordeaux's invitation to come and introduce myself. Of course, what Pastor Bordeaux said that we'd be, Lord, if the Lord wills, at the end of this week, have a call approved by the presbytery, and then looking to make the big move up from Costa Rica. The Lord has a funny sense of humor, because when we moved to Costa Rica, I kind of told my wife, I said, you know, I think we're here forever, because one international move in a lifetime's enough. Well, apparently not. So, my name's Nick. My wife's name is Rosie. Hey, stand up, honey. I don't mean to put you on the spot. We'll just introduce the other parts of the family that are here. This is my father, Bob. He's a physician in Leesville. His wife, Monica. You can stand up, Monica. It's all right. So we're missing four very important people, and those are our children, who are not with us today because they have school. And my mother was kind enough to go down and spend the time with them. So we have four kids. The oldest is 15. Her name is Esther. Then we have a 14-year-old, Abigail, an almost 10-year-old, Alexander, or Alex, and then an almost 8-year-old. She's turning 8 next week, tomorrow. Oh, that's right. It's tomorrow. Well, it's a good thing she's not here to have heard that. So yeah, she's turning 8 tomorrow. So we have a full house, and those are our wonderful children. Hopefully at some point everyone will get to at least meet them and see them there. Yeah. So I was asked to talk about how we actually ended up in Costa Rica. Now, I might start by asking a few questions, because this is fun to do sometimes. True or false? Or maybe, I don't know if I do true or false, or just, well, what do you guys know about Costa Rica? Not much. There's lots of mountains, and I will say, there are no mountains here in Texas, are there? Well, the highway system here is really impressive. I have to say that. I was kind of blown away by the infrastructure. But that doesn't really count as a mountain, I think. So yeah, lots of mountains. Anyone else? What do we know? Has anyone been to Costa Rica? Knock it off. That's not even fair. So what else do we... It's close. You're very close. Not in South America. It's in Central America. True or false? Costa Rica is an island. Oh, thank you. That's Puerto Rico, right? So, and actually, one time we had somebody who was coming down. This was years ago. They were coming down to do some construction help and work, and so they said, oh, well, they sent me the itinerary. They'd be getting in at 8 in the morning as we show up to the airport, and no one shows up. Then I get this call, and they ended up in San Juan, Puerto Rico, not San Jose, Costa Rica. So, and, of course, I once had a good friend. I was visiting them in San Diego, California, and his wife, we were talking about this years ago, too, and his wife says, oh, my, I don't know how you guys do it. Like, well, what do you mean? She goes, I just could not live where you live. All those huge snakes and spiders. And I'm like, what do you mean? She goes, well, I was watching the Nature Channel. I'm like, oh, sweetheart, listen. We live in the city. Of course, she was watching some program about the rainforest and big... And I said, I've never seen a big snake or... Well, I have seen a snake, but it was... But, you know, we just don't. So we live in the city. We live in a city called Cartago. And Cartago is in the central, what they call the Central Valley. It's, I don't know, what do you think, 120,000 people? And that's where we've lived for most of the time we've been there. The way we actually got to Costa Rica was interesting, because I was licensed in the Presbytery of the Midwest after attending Mid-America Reform Seminary. And then I took a pastoral internship out in New Jersey, in Pole Tavern, New Jersey. And near the end of that time, I get this call. I'm driving from the church back to our house one day, and I get this call. I didn't recognize the number at all, so I let it go to voicemail. And when I listened to the voicemail, it was one of these, "Hello, Nicholas Lame." My last name is LeMay. It's spelled L-A-M-M-E. So when I figure somebody doesn't know how to pronounce it, they probably don't know me at all. And I figured he was either he didn't introduce himself. He says, "If you could call, this is George, if you could call me back at," and he gave the number. I thought, well, he's either a telemarketer or a bill collector, and either way, I don't want to talk to either of them. So I ignored it. He tried to do this once or twice. I figured the next time he tried to do it, it had to be a bill collector, and I didn't know who I owed money to because he was real persistent. So I just continued to ignore it. Finally, I get this email where he does identify himself, and he was apparently an elder in a United Reformed Church in Michigan, and he had received my name from a good friend of mine who they were looking for a missionary to go down to Costa Rica to work in public and publishing and evangelism. And everybody they had talked to was committed. And finally, and then of course they were looking in the URC for somebody. So finally, the last guy they had talked to, who was a friend of mine, said, "No, look, you want to talk to Nick LeMay. He's out in New Jersey. He's in the OPC, but he'd be a great candidate." So they called me, and I talked to him finally and apologized for never answering their calls. I did tell him that I thought he was a telemarketer, and that's why I didn't answer his phone calls. And so that was okay, though. And so they asked me what I thought about mission work in Costa Rica, and I said, "Well, I don't know, send us down." And they did, and we loved it, and we decided to stay. The work that we saw there, we thought was a really great work, and so we've been down there for the last 10 years. Now, I primarily worked in Christian publishing, and at some point, about 6 months into it, less than that, I kind of got roped into pastoring a church. There was a pastor, but he was going to the United States. He was from the U.S., married to a Costa Rican lady, and they wanted to go to the U.S., and he wanted to do some studying. They wanted to get their immigration stuff figured out. So they left. They said, "We're only going to be gone for 2 years, and would you be willing to fill in for 2 years?" And so we worked all that out, and I said, "Sure, I should have gotten that 2 years in writing." Because I ended up pastoring the church for 7 years. And at that point, during that time, though, we worked in publishing. I also worked in theological education. I would travel there in Costa Rica, but also in other parts of Latin America. I'd go to Ecuador or Colombia, Mexico, different countries, and give and speak in different theological seminaries or training centers. So it was a lot of great experiences. At some point, made a decision to make a sort of a transition. And that transition ended up being from the work with the publishing and even the pastoring to working with the Costa Rican Bible Society. And that was a completely different experience and ministry. For the last 3 years, I've been managing projects for the Costa Rican Bible Society. Now, I don't know what you guys know about the Bible Society. It's very similar, yeah. Can anyone tell me anything about it? Okay, right. So most people think that, and that's true. We do. We focus on the distribution of the scriptures and translation. So but what a lot of people don't know is we also have a lot of other projects, a lot of other ministries that we do, and that I been the project manager and in charge of the projects department. So we have, for example, right now, and it, of course, every project or every ministry that we try to do has as its goal the distribution of the scriptures, or teaching people to read the scriptures, teaching, getting, promoting the reading and the distribution of the Bible. So, for example, we have one project that we've been doing for a number of years now, which is a project directed toward people with disability, especially visual disabilities. So that project involves the distribution of Braille Bibles. So as in Costa Rica, we've actually worked very hard on updating the Bible in Braille from an older version in Spanish, which is now quite difficult to read, to a more modern Spanish. So that's been a big project of ours, to update the Bible in Braille and distribute the Bible in Braille. We've been blessed to be able to partner with ministries, for example, here in the States, like Lutheran Braille Workers. They've been really wonderful in providing, printing. They have a press where they're able to print these Braille Bibles, and it's Braille on one side, Braille on the other. It's pretty impressive how they do it. And they've been able to help fund and donate to us Braille Bibles. A Braille Bible is, does anyone know how big a Braille Bible is? It's huge. Yeah, 6 boxes over 40 volumes. Yeah, it's when we take a Braille Bible to somebody's house, it's a lot of books. So you need a big place to put it, and they're expensive. You could spend $500 on a Braille Bible. I mean, not just one volume, but the whole thing.
What material? Aluminum?
No, it's more of a thick, sort of a thick cardstock that they use. But they have different technologies. So if you've seen anything in Braille, you might notice they punch it, right? So it's punched, and so the paper is perforated, but not entirely. So they get that. They have the raised dots, and they can read it. There's a new technology now where they use a sort of polymer, and they drop little dots on the page. Yeah, it's a certain polymer. It's pretty impressive, and it's much, much better. So you can print on both sides of the page, that you don't have to perforate it. So it's a lot. Yeah, it's more expensive, of course. So what we did a number of years ago is we created what we call an inclusive calendar, because there's a lot of families there are a lot of families who have children who are blind, or even parents who are blind. And actually in Costa Rica, there is a congenital, it's very common, I don't remember what it's called, pigmentaria retinosis? Retinosis pigmentaria? How do you say that in English? Right, something like that. So, but it's genetic. And it's something that is really prevalent in Costa Rica. So there's a lot of people, they're not born blind, but they become blind around age 20, late teens, early 20s. So there's a lot of families with parents who are blind, children who are seeing, or vice versa. And we made this calendar. It's a really beautiful calendar. So it's in print, but it's also in Braille, so that the whole family can use that. And materials, we've tried to make materials like this that are inclusive materials, so that the whole family can take advantage of these kind of things. This has been a real wonderful outreach. We also work with, there's a couple of blind pastors. And we've tried to work with them because they have a natural inroad to the non-seeing community. So this has been a wonderful, wonderful project, working with people with visual disabilities in Costa Rica. It's also allowed us to get into the public libraries. So we've distributed Braille Bibles to every public library in the entire country of Costa Rica. We've also given Braille Bibles I'm not sure to everyone, but we've tried. We're still working on it. To every public school library. And they're very grateful because there's not a lot of material for their blind students. And the law requires inclusive classrooms. So they don't segregate non-seeing children. And they have to somehow accommodate them. But there's just still not a lot of available resources. So having those Braille Bibles gives the school an additional resource. So they're very grateful. We've been able to work with the Ministry of Education. We've been able to work with the National Endowment for the Blind. And so a lot of NGOs, a lot of even government agencies have been very happy to work with the Bible Society in the distribution of Bibles. So it's been a really wonderful project. We have a project called Culture Peace, where we work with, again, this is another project where we've been able to make inroads even working with government agencies and other organizations, where we've created what we call Bible portions. So they're more like, not tracts, so to speak, but they're small publications that talk about biblical principles for establishing healthy relationships. And it's not just a project aimed at victims of domestic violence or violence, but also victimizers. So we also work in the prisons. We've been able to get into the prison systems, and for example, with Bibles, we give Bibles to every single inmate. We work with other ministries as well. So we partner with other ministries who work in the prison systems of spiritual education. So it's been a very, again, we try to get the Bible out. We try to get material out that shows people how to read it and is geared toward their circumstance or their situation. So we also take that Culture of Peace program into the public schools. Still in Costa Rica, they give religion in public schools. Because it's the only country in Latin America that is confessionally Roman Catholic. It's constitutionally Roman Catholic. So they have a state church. That has some advantages. The advantage is that in all public schools, they have religion by law. Now, it's more of a values program now. It's been quite watered down, which is okay. And that's good for us because it allows us to come in and give workshops, for example, like anti-bullying workshops and establishing positive relationship workshops, but from a biblical perspective. And we can come in with the Bible and talk about what the Bible teaches about loving our neighbor and how to. And I have a wonderful coworker. She's the one who really is spearheads that program, and she herself is blind. So she comes in with her dog, and everybody, it is so different that everyone really just kind of has to listen, right? And she's very creative, and she's also the one who spearheads, of course, the ministry to people with visual disabilities. So those are some really exciting programs that we have. We have another one that I'm very directly involved in, and that is translation of the scriptures. Now, I don't do the translation. In fact, the United Bible Society and every Bible society, we sort of have a policy that when we're going to translate the Bible, we train translators from among the people group. So in the past, the older paradigm was with, you know, whether it was with Wycliffe or SIL or the Bible Society. In the past, a missionary would go into a region, he'd learn the language, and then he'd begin translating the Bible. Well, that you can do it, but it takes a long time to do it. It takes a long, long time to do it. And that's why missionaries would be there 40, 50 years translating the New Testament. And then there's always a question of quality, because you're never as strong in a second language as you are in your first language. The nuances of a language, for example. What we do is we go into a region, especially when the people want the Bible. So normally we're asked to come in. We come in, we work with the community to identify the people that are most... Sorry, you guys, I don't speak in English very much. I've got to work on this. I'm sort of working in two languages here in my head. We get the people that are ideal for Bible translation, and then we have a school for translators. And so we send them to learn how to translate, basic principles of translation. And then we also set up, we have a team that gets set up. So we have a coordinator, we work with specialists in the languages. We have a translation consultant who works on the top level. He works with a lot of different teams. So we work with these people, and then we start translating. And it's a process. We have a very, very clear, we have a good process with a lot of checks and balances. And of course, we work with people whose native language is the language, is the receptor language. And that, we believe, tends to produce better Bible translations. And also, it gets the community involved. The translation belongs to the community. It wasn't the missionary who came in and did the translation. They did their Bible translation. So this is, right now in Costa Rica, where we have a project working with the Nove Indians. They kind of live on the southern part of Costa Rica, that borders Panama, and we're translating the New Testament right now. We really started in earnest last year, and we started with four translators, then we lost two of them. One of them, which was one of the gals, she got pregnant, and of course in those cultures, they have different views of women and role of women anyway, and her husband wasn't really keen on her translating anything. So at the end of the day, she was out, and then we had another translator who just kind of disappeared on us, and nobody knew where in the world he was or what he was doing. So we ended up with two. We started translating the Book of Mark. It was just a slow process. It took almost all year to translate the Book of Mark, and that was fine. And near the end of the year, the Lord blessed us with another translator. And this year we've got a fourth translator that's come on board. So between the end of last year and now, we've been able to finish, and we've got the Book of Mark done. We've finished Luke. There's two chapters left to go in John. Acts is well on the way. And Matthew, we got about 70% of Matthew translated. So by the end of this year, if the Lord wills, we'll have all four Gospels and Acts translated and ready. But then once they're translated, we do an internal review. So we'll pass the book on to another translator that didn't work on it, and he'll read it, and he'll do text corrections. He'll compare. So he'll do some translation corrections on that. Then it'll go back to the original translator, who will review those corrections, decide if they're good or not, and incorporate the ones that he feels are good, are proper to incorporate. So then once that's done, we do what we call an external review. So then we take that already internally reviewed document and we print it. And then we start taking it out to field test it in churches, in schools, families. We want people to read it. We don't just want them to read it privately in the home. We organize community readings where we'll read it out loud and people will be listening to it. And they'll give their feedback and how it feels as they hear it to make sure that the language is natural. Since most of the people will have had some or a bit of exposure to the Spanish, they also know the stories. And so they'll know if it's not right? If for some reason it's Peter raising the widow's son from the dead. Now we know we had a problem, but I won't be able to know that because I don't speak the language, but they do. And so we do that field testing. And once we believe that we've done enough field testing, we've gotten it around to all age groups, children, adults, elderly people. We try to, people with a lot of education, people with little education, we try to get it to all sectors of the population. Once we feel like we've got that nailed down, then we'll do a final, clean it up, format it, clean up the little jots and tittles, so to speak, and then that gets published. And let's say we only have the four Gospels and Acts yet, and we're still working on the rest, we'll still do a publication of the four Gospels in Acts. So we'll do that, and we'll begin to distribute that among the churches so that they can begin to use those portions in their language. Now, I know I had... Now, recently, I was speaking to some pastors in San Jose who I was... We got together because I wanted them to understand what the work was so that they're trying to find churches to support the work. And one pastor says, why should we be translating the New Testament into their language? I mean, most of them speak Spanish. They can just learn and they just keep reading in Spanish. I sat there and went, well, that's nice. Brother, do you speak any English? He says, well, yeah. I said, English is the lingua franca. It's spoken all over the world, right? He says, yeah. All right. Why read your Bible in Spanish? Just read her in English. Whole lot easier. Let's just translate the Bible in one language, and you can just read that language. And he said, well, no. I'm like, well, then why would you make them read it in Spanish? You know, and he never thought of it like that. He says, you don't hear it the same, right? It doesn't impact you in the same way when you're reading it in somebody else's language than when you read it in your own. So I said, and I told him, I said, because these people have a right to hear the word of God in their tongue, to hear the Lord speak to them through his word in their language. And so that really made a big difference for him in understanding. And actually after that, he was completely on board with the project. And that was great. So we have that project. I'm very involved in that project. And I'll probably, even come after coming up here, will continue to be very involved from a distance in that project. They don't want to lose me entirely. So that's been a wonderful experience working with Bible translation. We have other projects. Oh, yeah, go ahead. And something, and it's funny too, some things, like when you grow up with the hymns, I can say this for myself. I shouldn't slam the microphone like that. I grew up in the U.S., of course, with hymns in English, and I love the hymns in Spanish. I love them. I'm completely fluent in both languages. But there's always something about singing the hymn in English that hits me in a different way than singing in Spanish. One language is always going to be dominant, right? So, and in those cases, yeah, it's not going to sound the same to him. It sounds better in Spanish.
So what language do they speak?
They speak Noveri. The Nove people speak Noveri. I wish I could say even a phrase to you, but I can't. Oh, no, it's completely distinct. See, that's it. It's completely distinct. In fact, Noveri has even vowel sounds that Spanish doesn't have. So they have, four. It's at least three, but it may be four different vowel sounds that are more, that are nasal. They're nasal vowels, but they're very... We have some nasal vowels in English, but these are very like I try, you know. But even in the written text, we have to distinguish those nasal vowels with an umglot, with the two dots above there, so that there may, I think there are three nasal vowels in the language. But Spanish does not have those vowels. Spanish has five vowels, and they're very distinct. Whereas in Noveri, they have all the vowels that Spanish has, plus these other nasal vowels. So, no, and Noveri is also... The grammar and the way verbs work is different as well. So, these indigenous languages are very different, because especially Spanish has a Latin... history, you know, comes from the Latin, whereas this one has nothing to do with the Romance languages, so it's very different. Also, you can see how the language affects, you know, the culture as well, and the way people think, and how the, some very funny things. You wouldn't think about it this way, or you wouldn't think about this maybe right away, but working with the team, right? We'll get together and have 2-3-day workshops together. And you discover, for example, they go, well, how are we going to translate this word? Like, what word? Wheat. Well, Spanish is a word, trigo. But there's no word in their language for wheat. There's a language for corn. But wheat is not native to their world. And so there's no word for it. Or camel. Okay, there's no word in their language for camel. So what do you do when there's no... You borrow it. Camello. You borrow it from Spanish. I have a list. I keep this running list of interesting things about the language, right? But I don't have that with me. But it's just funny when you run into these things where they say, for example, in Mark, the word for unclean spirit, they don't have a term for demon. They don't have a term for unclean spirit. I've got it written down somewhere. They have a different way of saying it. And it's not something that would be really obvious to you or me right away. And so things like that are very interesting. And you work to find ways around those linguistic differences between languages. So that is, I think, is perhaps one of the projects that I love the most. I have time for maybe one more quick. Oh, go ahead.
You kind of just alluded to what I was going to ask. So are you guys translating from the Spanish Bible into Costa Rican or the text?
Such a good question. Maybe I won't have time for one more, but... Okay, so we train these men or women. We have tried to get as diverse a translation team as possible. But we don't, in general, they don't know the original languages. They aren't conversant in Koine Greek or classical Hebrew or Aramaic. So we generally pick a base text in Spanish because they're all bilingual. And they'll translate from that base text in Spanish into their language. Now that's, okay, that's not ideal, of course, because now it's a translation once farther removed from the original languages. We do have a way around that. And so we have always involved in the translation projects what they call the exegete, all right? That would be actually my job, because somebody who does know the original languages and somebody who can go through the text working with the translators and who's aware of important exegetical textual issues in the original and can ask the right questions. So I can go through and ask how they're translating this part, or what they're doing with this terminology, how they're working with this terminology. And so we try to get through that barrier in that way. And so my job, for example, is, now that Mark's done, I have to do a revision. Now, I have no idea what I'm doing in their language. Well, a little bit. You get to know certain things, but I know the right questions to ask. So then I'll work with the head of the translation team, and he and I will go through, we'll spot check passages. Or when we get together, one of the things that we do is we do read alouds. And so one man will sit there and he'll start reading his text, and the others are listening. And they'll go, I don't think that's right. I think it needs to be translated differently. And inevitably they're like, Nick, what does the original say? What does the Greek say? And so then I'll say, well, look, this term in the Greek. I'll give you a real interesting example. So we have one man on the team who's Roman Catholic. We have one Seventh-day Adventist on the team. We have two. We have one person who's Pentecostal and another person who. Really, I don't know what he is, to be quite honest. But I think more Baptist or something like that. We have a very we have a very diverse team. One of them is he has a master's degree in linguistics from the University of Costa Rica. So just because they're indigenous does not mean they're uneducated in Costa Rica. One of them has a master's degree in linguistics. He's a Seventh-day Adventist. He also works for the University of Costa Rica and works for the Ministry of Education. Extremely sharp individual. Of course, the Catholic priest is also well-trained in both Hebrew and Greek and theology, at least Roman Catholic theology. But that's a real big plus when we're bringing in people into this translation project. One of them is really, I'll be honest, I'm not really sure if he has even sixth grade. But he's still real sharp. He's gone through our translation school, and he plods along. He translates slower than the others, and he does a really good job. And then we have another guy who has a bachelor's degree in education, and he's a teacher in the local school system as well. So we have different education levels, different backgrounds. We sat down to do the read aloud of Mark. And we got to the part where it says that John was baptizing in the Jordan. And they had translated it, John was submersing in the Jordan. Because baptizing, we don't have a word for baptize in Noveri. But, so they were giving the meaning. Well, of course, this had been translated by two people whose idea of baptism is submersion. The Roman Catholic, the priest in the room says, I don't really like that term. Now, I didn't like that term either. I'm sitting here going, all right, well, but I got to keep my little mouth closed most of the time for this kind of stuff. He says, I don't really like that term. To me, the word submerse that you're using in our language would be like to take some clothes and just dunk it in the water and pull it out. I said, I think we need to use a different term that means to get wet, to bathe. And so I was completely 100% on the side of the priest. I thought, this is right. But so we had quite a discussion. And here's where my presence there was important. I said, well, Nick, what's the term? I said, oh, well, I should have brought more literature for you guys to read. And so we discussed it, but we discussed the term baptizo, and we discussed how this is used and all this stuff. So still, you know, even after all that, what we ended up deciding, again, this is just how stuff happens and happens in team, as a team. And this is what makes and what will make the translation very good. It was decided, the majority felt, that submerse was best to leave in the text. But we were going to include a footnote. And the footnote would give a further explanation of the term baptizo and how else it can be understood or used, how else other people understand it. So that made the Catholic happy. That made me happy, and everybody else was satisfied with adding explanatory footnotes. One thing that did was made the translation richer, because now it's not just the translation, but now we're beginning to add explanatory notes in the footnote to the text to help people understand better what they're reading. Then I think all okay. 5 minutes, or okay, or I've gone 5 minutes over. Oh, okay, just like. So that's a great question, and this happens all the time. We run into these things, especially when we have people from diverse backgrounds, because of course, no one translates in a bubble, right? Especially the Bible. People bring their background. They say, you know, and I don't buy it, but they say in the Bible Society that, well, we try to leave theology out of translation, right? No, please. Everyone brings their theological background to the task. But that's why we need a diverse group of people. Because that diversity counteracts one or another theological tendency. And I think it makes for a much healthier translation. It at least creates circumstances where we can add other perspectives on the text or on the meaning of words into the footnotes, and then create a much better Bible. So that's one of the things. It's really exciting. It's a lot of great, it's exciting work, and thankfully I'll work on it from a distance, because most of the work is from a distance anyway, because they work wherever they are, and we communicate through WhatsApp and some video conference sometimes, and only every once in a while we all get together, have some coffee and bread and do some read-alouds. But those are, it's great. I'll just say, without going into any detail, I'll stop there. What I will say is that, so I'm now coming up, Lord willing, or we're up here now, and this weekend I'll be at Presbytery with Reverend Bordeaux as well, and Lord willing to be examined to come into the Presbytery and for the Presbytery to approve the call as the Harvey evangelist, and really looking forward to beginning a new challenge, coming in, working with people who have been severely affected by the hurricane. It's one of those things where you tell people that, I've told people that, and they go, well, that came and went. I'm like, well, no, the media got bored of it. And so, because they're not reporting on it anymore, apparently it doesn't exist anymore, but it's not true. And so, really hoping, if the Lord should will, to be able to reach out to families, make new contacts, bring the gospel and hope to people that don't feel like they have any, perhaps. And start Bible studies. Get the churches praying. Really, I hope this isn't the last time that I'm here talking about, the work and getting groups in the churches to pray for it regularly, to be involved in community outreach. And, if the Lord should will, bring people into our churches who really need contact with the Lord Jesus Christ and who really need to know His Word and need a community where they're nurtured and they can grow in faith, new faith or even refound faith. This is here in Houston, yeah. I really hope to establish, and with the help of my very organized wife, to be sending out regular communication to the churches about the work that's going on. Yeah. So pray for us. Pray for this, because we're very excited about it, and we think the Lord is opening up for us anyway a new ministry and then just a totally new direction. So I'm very excited to be up here, and it's a real pleasure to have met you and to be able to talk. I wasn't sure what I was going to be talking about in Sunday school, but I hope it's been enlightening in some sense. So, thank you, guys.